Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events throughout our seven-county listening area in central Iowa. Thanks for listening. I'm Susan Franzen, your host for today. Later in the program, we'll be talking about immigrants and refugees here in central Iowa, as well as a local perspective on the month of Ramadan, which began last Sunday. But first, nature reporter Pat Schlarbaum will be interviewing Doug Haar about some birds you may have noticed during the past few weeks, red-winged blackbirds.
Yeah, today with Doug Haar, we're enjoying the advance of spring. And one of the things we notice are big flocks of migrating birds. Today with Doug Haar, he had a sighting that I'd like to share with our listeners. Hey, Doug.
Hi, Pat.
Could you tell us about your flock of blackbirds?
Yeah, it was about 6:40 this morning, and I'd gotten up a little bit earlier. And anyway, it was getting light out, so I pulled up the shades on our front bow window. And as I look out, I see this massive flock of blackbirds coming apparently probably from the Harrier Marsh Wildlife Area on the south side of Highway 30.
They're at Ogden.
Yes, they're at Ogden. They were flying over town and coming. It looked like it was just the start of the flock coming this way, and it was a massive, massive number of blackbirds in the front of the flock. And I really couldn't determine. You know, it was probably a mixed flock of blackbirds and grackles and cowbirds and a number of different things. But of course, the early morning light and in flight, roughly a quarter of a mile away, probably. Yeah. Really couldn't determine what all of it was there, except it was a massive flock of blackbirds. So I started trying to do a little counting of the front of the flock, the big initial pulse, and it was very difficult to do, but I've estimated wildlife flocks or bird flocks for a long time in my career, and I'm guessing there was well over 5,000 birds in the first pulse, and then it thinned out a little bit, but then hundreds, if not thousands of more, were kept pouring past, continuous line, no stop of them, and then here comes another big pulse, and then it goes down a little bit, and then another big pulse again, and this just kept on going with the continuous flights and these big pulses of 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 in a flock, and it continued for 3 minutes, roughly 3 minutes, before there was just finally a few trailing birds. And when I tried adding everything up, thinking what there might be stringing between the big flocks, I have little doubt that there was probably at least 100,000 birds that passed over Ogden in about 3 minutes this morning.
What a fantastic story to share. Tell us a little bit about the Harrier Marsh and probably where they overnighted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Harrier Marsh is quite well-renowned for its big roosting site for blackbirds on migration, both in the spring and fall. And I have seen flights like this in past years. It's been probably 3 or 4 years since I've seen one quite this size. But we will see massive numbers of blackbirds just before sunset and early in the morning. If you drive past Harrier Marsh, you'll see massive numbers sitting out there on the cattails and the grasses and the food crops that are left out there for wildlife and things. So it's sometimes the whole surface or the whole, if you look across the landscape, it's almost like it's a field of corn, but it's all black-topped corn because there's blackbirds sitting on absolutely every piece of vegetation at the wildlife area.
Yeah, well, what a great public area to have in central Iowa. What a great story. Are you aware of any population declines in any of these blackbirds?
I have just read an article recently. It's a summary of a scientific article, but it states that it appears that common grackles are actually in decline across North America. Now, that may be surprising to a lot of people who have yards full of blackbirds nesting in their evergreen trees and leaving white droppings on their car in the driveway and other things.
If you could describe a grackle to our listener.
A Okay. Yeah. A grackle is a little bit bigger, probably about 50% bigger, I'm going to say, than a common red-winged blackbird. It has quite a long tail, and it has a metallic glossy color, especially to the head. It can be sort of a greenish or purplish color in the light, and they have light-colored eyes. So they're quite easy to distinguish from other blackbirds. But when they're migrating or when they stop in our yard and they're under their feeders, they're all grouped together. So you'll see three or four different kinds of blackbirds in a flock like that easily.
Sure, and the eye of the grackle is kind of always jumps out at me. Could you describe their eye?
Yes. Well, it's just it almost looks like a bird is a little bit frightened.
Yeah.
I guess that would be the way to describe it. You notice the eye of a grackle much faster than you do the eye of a red-winged blackbird or a cowbird or something like that. Yeah. It's just wide-eyed and almost got kind of a frightened look to it.
Yeah.
I would say that's a decent description of it.
Yes, it is. I was kind of prying there for your description of kind of a unique look of in a bird's eye.
Yeah. And, you know, and there are a couple of other blackbirds, too, that can sometimes look a little bit like grackles and will also be seen in mixed flocks, and those would be Brewer's blackbirds, which look just a little bit like smaller versions of a grackle, and then rusty blackbirds, which are getting to be quite rare. They've declined about 70% in the last three or four decades, so we don't see nearly as many rusty blackbirds as we used to. But,
but
the Brewer's blackbirds will sometimes be mixed in and can be mistaken for grackles, actually, too.
Yeah, and the rusty, could you give us a few field marks for those?
Yeah, they tend to be, they're a blackbird, but they have a slightly rusty coloration to them, and especially the females look quite rusty.
Yeah.
But a little bit on the flanks and the upper portion of the back of the blackbirds, you'll see this slightly rusty coloration. And the eye coloration can be a little bit different, too. And they've got just a slightly different chirping sound than regular blackbirds.
Oh.
You kind of have to work to pick them out of a flock when they're mixed in with other blackbirds.
Yeah, and I like to include that because there are some birders in our audience that know to look for those. I used to take all the blackbird sightings, you know, kind of take them for granted, and then sure enough, you'd start picking out the rusty ones, and it kind of gave us an incentive to look through a lot of birds just to find those few rusties that might be included, knowing that their population is declining.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, we don't see so many big flocks in our backyards anymore because we have a lot of trees planted now. But when we first moved here, it was pretty well wide open in our backyard and extending into neighbors' yards. And we would see big flocks of migrating blackbirds land in the yard. And I've actually picked out all those species of blackbirds mixed in a flock here in town in the big open area behind our house.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. Thank you, Doug Haar. These are just great observations of the wilds, and you're in a special spot over there on the west bank of the Des Moines River and Harrier Marsh, and have a good day.
Oh, thank you very much. It was a fun thing to view this morning.
This environmental update is sponsored by the Outdoor Alliance of Story County, Story County's Conservation's Friends Group, working to enhance outdoor recreation, education, and conservation. Information can be found at oasco.org.
In case you just tuned in, this is KHOI Community Radio, and you've been listening to Pat Schlarbaum and Doug Haar talking about red-winged blackbirds. Turning to the main theme of today's program, I'd like to play a collage drawn from our past programs about recent immigrants here in Iowa. We'll start with Rick Exner speaking from A Day Without Immigrants at the Iowa Capitol in 2017. Marissa Barco will be telling about the closing of El Buen Gusto, a Salvadoran restaurant in Perry last March. And we'll hear from Janet Turing, the director of the All Cultures Equal Community Center in Webster City.
What's going on there at the Capitol?
We're about 2 blocks worth of people, and we're getting ready to move west toward the Capitol, which is about 3 blocks from here. People are honking. There are signs up. La gente unida, people united. My parents pay more taxes than your president. Little guy holding that one. And lots of American flags.
What is this event called?
Day Without Immigrants. You know, in Iowa, undocumented immigrants pay $50 to $70 million in state taxes every year. That's just the undocumented immigrants. And $60 to $80 million in federal taxes and Social Security taxes, which of course they're not collecting a penny on. So undocumented immigrants nationally are recognized for paying 5% of our Social Security debt.
Well, now, if they're undocumented, how do you know they're paying Social Security?
This was a study done by the Iowa Policy Institute, and it's about 10 years old now, so it's probably conservative. And you can just drive down many main streets in small towns in Iowa and see how they have saved the main street because of the stores and the people on the street buying. They're making a great contribution to our economy here. If this contribution were not being made, we'd be a poor country in many ways.
For our second story, I went to Perry and spoke with Edith Barco when I learned that her family's restaurant, El Bueno Gusto, was being closed because her parents were leaving to avoid being deported. Here's her story.
My dad's from Guatemala, my mom's from El Salvador. So they came here to California in the 90s, I believe like 93 or 94. Then I was born in California in 95. And then they came here when I was like 3 months old to Iowa. My dad started working at Tyson. And then like my mom just stayed home taking care of me. And then she started working at Tyson for a couple years. She didn't like it, so she started, cooking at home, and a lot of people would go to the house and stuff, and then that became a problem. So she got a taco truck, and then in 09, they opened the restaurant, and they started working ever since here.
And it sounds like it's been quite successful.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that come, a lot of people that know us, so...
I know that you have a big Latino population in Perry. Are more of your customers Latino, or are they about half and half?
I believe half and half. It's all type of people come here, so.
Why did your parents leave Central America?
There was a war going on at that time, so.
But they were not refugees?
No.
What has been their status? How did they? What was their first visa, and when did they apply for citizenship?
Well, they have had work visas for more than 20 years, I think, and then they started their case and becoming citizens 15 years ago, and it's been a long process. They've had the same lawyer for 15 years, and then he never did nothing, I guess, and then. We got this new lawyer not that long ago. When my parents got the first letter, when I was 18, they had immigration court to see if they would become resident or get deported. And they were waiting for that answer, and they finally got it like a year ago that said that they were going to be deported. And so then my dad got a new lawyer, and he appealed it, and that lasted for like 6 months or so. And then they just got this new letter that they said that they would have to go and wait for residency or citizenship because I had applied for them. I had asked for them. So hopefully we get the answer back quick, or letting them come back or not.
So they've never been really undocumented, right?
No, never, because they've always had work permits and stuff, and they've always done their taxes and all that. So
another town that has been enriched by immigrants is Webster City. I talked with Janet Turing, the director of All Cultures Equal Community Center.
A group of people were recognizing that the Laotian population and the Hispanic population and other cultures needed a place, a community center to learn and to grow and to test their wings here in the United States that they feel safe at and good at. And this is an old, I think it was like Shopper's Supply kind of building, and so they expanded it just a little bit, and everybody worked on it on a volunteer basis to build it. And Doug Bailey was one of the founders, and he is what, and his wife, who she's a teacher, he's a board of supervisors. So we're sitting in a classroom, and one of the walls, Nancy Bailey said, when we were working on this wall, the people working on this wall were from 9 different countries. So how cool is that, you know? And so it was brought together, and a lot of it was like they could rent the building for different events. We've had meetings from all over the county, all over the country. In fact, Hamilton County is second in Laotian population in all of our 99 counties here in Iowa. And that's because our churches here have brought people after the Vietnam War and their families and friends and other people from their villages come and join us here. They have interesting stories to tell. So Chin is one of our immigration people. Chin and I have been to a paralegal law class where we have learned to become qualified paralegals. And this ACE is becoming recognized by the Department of Justice to help people on the legal pathway to citizenship in a recognized sort of a way. And so she was from one of the families that came over, and her father, who lives next door to us in ACE, he was fighting with the U.S. soldiers in the Vietnam War. And so after the war was over, his home and him and he himself were targeted by Cambodia to be destroyed. So he was hidden in the jungle for several months until U.S. soldiers brought him supplies once a week and a little bit of money until he had enough money. So they walked like 19 days or something to Thailand, and they crossed the Mekong River in the middle of the morning with the guns blazing above them and went to a Thailand refugee camp. So Chin is one of the little girls that came with her family that way, and Asbury Methodist Church helped them to come here. And since they were here, and he was like the shaman and the mayor of his community, other people have come here that are popular. So Webster City is the home of this group of Laotians. There's only one other place that this group of Laotians at, and I think it's in Canada. And so sometimes they have big meetings here, international meetings here that we don't even know about. And but they happen here, so I know about them.
This is KHOI Community Radio, and I am Susan Franzen, your host for today. We've been hearing stories about immigrants and some refugees on local talk programs during the past couple of years. Our next guests will bring us up to date.
In order to find out what's happening with immigrants and refugees in Ames, and I guess in the state of Iowa, I have a couple of members of the newly formed Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance. I have David Hansen and Lewis Rosser. Lewis, would you start and tell us how IRA, as the acronym reads, got started?
Sure. Well, thank you very much for having us here today, Susan. We really appreciate the opportunity to share the information locally. We came together about 3 years ago, in 2016, with just the purpose to make Ames a very welcoming place for refugees and provided the opportunities here in Ames that Des Moines and other bigger cities in Iowa have been doing for many years. Also, one of our goals was to not only assist arriving families here in Ames from other countries, but also to educate ourselves and the community on the issues related to refugees and also to advocate on their behalf.
And David, could you tell me what the difference is between an immigrant and a refugee?
Yeah, that's really important because there's a lot of confusion. Starting with immigrants, the Amnesty International says there's no accepted international definition of what an immigrant is. The immigrants seek to locate and live in another country. They undergo vetting process by the U.S. Embassy or the consulate of the country they're fleeing from. There's really a complexity of categories of how you come in under the immigrant status. But they have to have a place to work and live. They can return to their own country if they want to, if they feel safe. And they receive no initial government financial support. On the other hand, refugees is a clear category. They flee their home country either due to persecution that's based on race or religion, membership, violence, or political reasons. And it's important that they live in resettlement camps from the United Nations until they can return home or relocate. The vast majority of those are seeking to return back to their home, hoping things will get better. They can become citizens if they resettle in the U.S. They're completely legal, whereas immigrants, they may or may not be documented. And they all undergo a strong United Nations and State Department vetting process that we can get into more details in a bit.
So why did you feel that you needed an interfaith group to deal with these people? Are there many here in Ames?
Well, there is a substantial refugee community, but in terms of new arrivals, there are very few, and it's very hard to be able to get in line and be allocated a new arrival. We started out as an interfaith group. That's where the interest was, but it's expanded to social justice groups or individuals also that are interested in supporting refugees. So if this were our slideshow, this is where I'd interject the instructions of major faiths all over the world to take in the neighbor, love your neighbor, take in the alien as sort of expectations of the different faith groups. In terms of the faith of the refugees, I want to mention there's been a very dramatic change in those coming to the United States. In 2016, the numbers were about equal between Christians and Muslims, about 44% each. 2 years later, 2018, the Christians went from 44% to 71%. The Muslims dropped from 44% to 14%. So there's been a huge change in what the U.S. is accepting as refugees.
I was recently at a gathering of Sudanese, and I met two men who said they were here under the lottery. What is the lottery?
Lottery is one way you come in as an immigrant.
As an immigrant?
Yes.
Not as a refugee.
One of various ways.
What is the basis for U.S. participation in this?
Of course, we have the Statue of Liberty. That's one notable declaration. But the main one is found in the United Nations Universal Doctrine of Human Rights. The United States was instrumental in developing that document, getting it passed, a milestone document on human rights, and we're a signatory to that document. Article 14 says everyone has the right to seek and enjoy in other countries asylum from persecution. So that's the strongest statement of our obligations.
I know you are an economist and love statistics, global and U.S. So do you have any statistics to give us?
Oh, you're going to get them started.
Yeah, starting at the global level, the latest I have are 2016, except that this increased by 10% in 2017. 2016 was the highest in history, and each year after, we've broken that record. There were, at that point, over 65 million forcibly displaced persons. Of those, 22.5 million were refugees who left their home country. Over 5 million of those are Palestinians, but those are handled by a different agency within the United Nations than the other refugees. The average time these people spend as refugees is 17 years. The most vulnerable, obviously, are the women, survivors of torture, orphans, other minors who have been separated their families.
Yep, that's where they come from, and the stories are just so dramatic. We'd love to come back sometime and share with you some of our Sudanese families that we've been supporting recently here in Ames and share with you their stories. But they're very compelling individually, just to survive. And these are typically women with just their children, not always a full, you know, mother, father, situation. And a lot of times it's just women, you know, with her 1, 2, 3, or 4 children, trying to survive for months, if not years on end, before they get even an opportunity to find a country that will take them. And a lot of times, and they go to get on an airplane, they don't even know where they're going until they get on the plane, until they actually land in the country. And that's been a common occurrence for many years.
So how do people get from getting off the plane, wherever it is, New York, Chicago, and how do they get to Ames, Iowa?
That's a good question. You know, it's there are particular communities that are designated to support refugee families. Ames is not officially recognized right now. That is one of the goals of IRA, to become recognized officially and to do that in the future. It's a process that we have to go through. It takes several years. The families are taken to various places throughout the country. There's whether it's Des Moines here in Iowa or Minnesota, the Twin Cities area for Sudanese in particular, they have a large Sudanese population in that area.
Want me to get back to my statistics?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I didn't know you had more statistics.
You had to ask an economist about numbers, so you could probably get some more.
Excuse me. Okay.
Well, there's one that I think is important because there are some misperceptions of where these people come from. Yeah. Some people think, they must come from Mexico, Central America. And that's not correct at all. And if we think a little broader, we'd remember that really the vast majority come from the Near East and South Asia, 42%. Second to that, they come from Africa, 37%. And if we combine Mexico, Central America, South America, and the Caribbean all together, they make up 1.5%. So the refugees that come to the United States have very little, nothing to do with Mexico or Central America.
Many of the immigrants are fleeing the same kind of conditions that are present in Africa or Southeast Asia.
Absolutely. But the point is, we have a commitment. We have ceilings on what we will accept for refugees. And they all come in legally, automatically. In fact, I should go through the vetting process because there's also a lot of misperceptions. People think we're lax in letting them in. Everybody's dying to come into the United States. Insufficient vetting. So I think it's important to be clear on what happens there.
Although I have heard quite a few people at the southern border who came applying for refugee status.
No, I don't think so. I think they come for asylum.
Correct.
Asylum, and that's not the same thing.
That's okay. Not the correct. Same.
So could you
That's
explain
an immigrant. Okay, so for the vetting, there are two phases. First is vetting by the United Nations. So it passes through the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. They require interviews, screenings, reference checks in their home countries that they fled from, biological screenings. Then they turn over to select international organizations to assist with the processing and collecting of documents conducting more interviews with families and looking for discrepancies. They go through this mass of data and they decide which ones could be eligible as refugees to be relocated. Then the United Nations decides which country do we want to go to try to place these refugees. Like Lewis says, they have no idea where they're going. They're not looking at coming to the United States because they have no information what might be happening. So the United Nations then comes to the United States for a second phase of vetting. Homeland Security officer takes this huge document pile from the United Nations, does a taped interview with a candidate abroad in that country. If he passes that, then the U.S. government completes its own screening process. It involves 8 different U.S. federal agencies, 6 different security databases, 5 separate background checks. You're looking surprised. 4 biometric security checks, 3 separate interviews in person, 2 interagency security checks. I say, and a partridge in the pear tree. But anyway, that's the vetting process. If they pass all of that, then they're allocated to one of 9 NGOs who then have the responsibility of helping find jobs, interviewing them in the community, adjusting life to the U.S. and these kinds of things. Lewis says, it isn't that they start with less than nothing. They start negative because they're obligated to pay back the airplane ticket that they arrived with. That's so
true.
That's the vetting process. Now I think it'd be good to look at what is the U.S. doing.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes. Okay.
How well are we stepping up to the plate in what is really an escalating human tragedy?
And this is really a human tragedy around the world. It's not just the U.S.
Oh, I can tell that. Yes. Yes.
Right.
And the difference between asylum and refugee status, you know, many of the people who are seeking asylum
They're basically doing that on their own volition. Their governments aren't involved. The UN is not involved. You know, they're just picking up their families. You know, we see these young mothers walking, you know, through Mexico with their children on their hips and showing up at the border. That's something that they're doing all on their own. Whereas the refugees are, the UN is involved, the government's involved, and there are certain amounts of, some basic supports, even though they have an obligation to repay that airplane ticket. There are some initial supports that are given to, refugees once they arrive here, but those supports have been dwindling over in recent years, and, David will kind of hit on that a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately, a number of our politicians would say we're the best in the world, we're number one. Unfortunately, they're confused. They don't have the right numbers because they're confused between refugees and immigrants. Unfortunately, in 2016, we were number 18 in the world, just barely ahead of Yemen. But there's a better measure than the absolute numbers, and that would be in terms of percentage of populations in the country. If you look at percentage of the population, we dropped to number 77 in the world. If instead you look at even a better measure in terms of commitments compared with your gross national products, your ability to pay, we dropped to number 107 in the world as a host to refugees. Worse, what's been happening recently in the United States? In 2016, the number that entered the United States were 95,500. In 2017, the ceiling was 90,000. We have to declare a ceiling to the United Nations of those we are willing to take. But in 2018, the 90,000 ceiling dropped to a historic low of half that, 45,000 allowed in. But worse, the actual number of that 45,000 that were actually admitted was 21,000. That ceiling was dropped this year from 45,000 to 30,000. So our commitment has dramatically changed our world position compared to the 95,000 just in 2016 that were admitted. Worse, the budget for United States Committee for Refugees and Immigrants 2018, that budget, 25% in the face of the huge increase in those years at a world level. So I'd end off my part. How does the rest of the world see us? And you'd have to say the United States is no longer seen as the humanitarian leader in the world. And I'd say maybe you don't care. Don't be silent when people say we're number one. We're no longer the humanitarian leader in the world.
We were at that point, many years ago. I'm very proud of it. And Iowa actually led the charge for many, many years. In 1975, Governor Ray was one of the first advocates in the United States to come forward and address this issue. At that time, following the Vietnam War, or as it was just wrapping up, he led the way in settling over 1,200 Tidam refugees here from Southeast Asia. No other state was doing this at this time. It was the first state not only to accept these refugees and welcome them with open arms, but also set up a resettlement agency within state government to provide services just like at the federal level, providing direct services to refugees, families as they were coming to Iowa. So Iowa led the way until about the 1990s in supporting refugees using this agency. Now, of course, this agency would work with other NGOs such as Catholic Social Services, Lutheran Social Services, other NGOs that would also be partners in helping support and settle the refugees throughout the state. Unfortunately, Iowa has fallen to number 20 in the nation. So we were in the 70s and 80s, we were number one, but now we've fallen to number 20 in the state in providing assistance to refugees and in helping them resettle. At the same time that David referenced, the federal grants were being terminated or decreased, the same thing began to start happening here in Iowa in the 90s and 2000s and going forward. So it's been a real struggle that then put the burden more so on to those NGOs and the Catholic Social Services, religious organizations, and the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants, even though it still functions to this day, they just don't have anywhere near the resources that they used to in the past. So that's been one of the biggest changes. So that's why in 2016, the pressures that we hear in Ames and a lot of faith groups saw, and it wasn't just faith groups. There were others that came together. I remember vividly the day when there was about 80 of us all sitting in a room in a great big circle. And I love that setup. Instead of a theater style when you see this back of somebody's head, but we were set in a circle so we could all face each other and talk about the challenges and how we wanted to address as a community, not just a faith community, but as a community to help these families come to Ames and how we can make Ames a more welcoming place for them to really make it happen. Now, I can't take all the credit for it. AMUS, the Mid-Iowa Organizing Strategy Group, kind of gave us a little bit of the idea. So we don't want to take complete credit that, we ran in here and they had done a lot of work throughout Central Iowa about asking communities to do that. And that's where we kind of grabbed the ball and ran with it. in 2016. In 2017, we were so excited when we brought our first family to Ames. And yes, they were from South Sudan. And they, it was a mother and her three children who, you know, really needed the help. Yes, they have some basic, federal, assistance for a few months for like rent or a few months for food assistance. But compared to 20 years ago when it was, you know, several months or years, now it's literally down to 3 or 4 or 6 months. It's a dramatic cut. And you can imagine, along with finding a job, you know, and getting your children in school and making all the other, those other arrangements to get that all done in such a short period of time is virtually impossible. Especially when you're dealing in this particular family with a language barrier. When, you know, the mother, the children might actually have some English when we get here, especially once they get enrolled in school and they start reading and speaking English. But the parents often don't. And that's something that we then do. I'll talk about some of the things that we do in 2018. And we brought a second family from, also from South Sudan. She came with her children, and, you know, has just been great. And getting assimilated into the American society, and she's got a great short story to tell. I'd love to have her come back sometime, and she can share that with you, because it's very heartwarming, tragic and heartwarming at the same time. But what Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance really does for these families, let's get to the skinny of that. We do our best to hook them up with the social services and making sure that they're getting what they're supposed to through the federal and state agencies in relation to food assistance, housing assistance, if they're eligible for that. They're eligible for the federal assistance for just a matter of a few months. But after that, you know, they do qualify based on their income if they've got a job. But usually they do, because that's one of the things that we do help them do is navigate finding a job to get settled into. That's usually the first best way for us to give them their assistance, because, you know, that hopefully comes with other supports of insurance and, you know, more stability for the family with that income.
Since the refugees mentioned by David Hansen and Lewis Rosser are Muslims, it seemed appropriate to mark the beginning of the holy month of Ramadan. Imam Jahili at the Darul Aqwam Islamic Center in Ames says members of the mosque represent 80 countries. One of the members of the Ames Mosque is Aladdin Al-Kathari, KHOI volunteer and frequent engineer for Local Talk. His story surprised me, and I think it will surprise you.
Pennsylvania, here in the good old U.S. of A. We did not practice Islam in my family. Actually, in my household, we didn't really practice any religion. The way I became Muslim, or the way I decided to begin practicing Islam, was, you know, I used to read a lot, you know, as a kid. I loved to read. I read everything I got my hands on. And I think that is what ultimately drove me to choose Islam, but it's difficult to say exactly what it was that influenced me to be drawn to it, because, you know, we're influenced by a lot of things from the time we're born, and it's not always, we don't always remember what those influences are. But I remember when I was young, for example, I used to go places with relatives or other people, and I remember hearing the name Allah mentioned at one particular place. I must have been about 5 or 6 years old. And I don't remember the context of that, except I remember the people were saying that. And, of course, growing up in the 60s and 70s in Philadelphia, there existed the Nation of Islam in this country back then. They were pretty influential in African-American communities. So, you know, the influence could have come from there, or, you know, I knew people who said they were Muslim, but my own journey kind of happened for me 38 years ago. So in high school, I couldn't wait to finish. I finished school. I couldn't wait to just leave, just to go somewhere, just to get my life started, whatever that meant. Pretty anxious to just travel, to go somewhere. So a year or so before that, I had met someone who was from California, and I decided, okay, I'll go there. So that Saturday afternoon, I went to see my father, as I did every Saturday, probably for the last 6 or 7 years before that. When I saw him, I asked him for some money so I could travel. And I remember he gave me about $200. And it wasn't as much as I wanted, but it was what he gave me at the time. And it was enough to buy a Greyhound bus ticket, which was about $120. And so I went, I bought the bus ticket for later that night, realizing that it was a 3-day bus ride. I went to a couple of my favorite bookstores in Philly and, you know, for something to read on the trip. And this particular bookstore I went to, I had been gone there for years, so I was pretty familiar with, you know, all of their books, all of their selections. But I'm looking around, I'm browsing the shelves, and after about 30 or 40 minutes, I found a couple books. I remember one of the books was poetry by Khalil Gibran, and the other was a small paperback Quran translated to English. So I had heard about the Quran before, but I had never actually got my hands on one. They weren't very easy to find in this country until about after 1992, actually. So anyway, I bought the books, I went home, packed some other things, clothes, food for my trip. That evening, I got on the bus. You get on a bus, you get a little comfortable, it pulls off, and I started to read the Quran. Took me about 2 days to read the whole book. So I remember reading it. I was captivated, kind of, by what I was reading. You know, and this wasn't the first religious text that I had read. You know, years before, I had read many religious texts, including some Buddhist books. The Three Baskets, I remember that one, which was, you know, contained some precepts for Buddhist monks and nuns. I read the Torah. I read, of course, the Bible. We studied that in school. I went to a Quaker school. And every time I would read a religious book or a book that, you know, the text of some religion, I would seek out someone who practiced that particular religion and ask questions kind of to learn a little bit more, you know, fill the gaps of my understanding. So, and I wasn't looking for a religion. I was just, back then, I was just curious. So when I read the Quran on the bus, it really changed me. It changed the way I thought about everything that I would do. You know, I suddenly had this sense of purpose, it seemed like. You know, it seemed to kind of answer questions that I never asked.
It
wasn't really questions that I asked, but I know in the other books and religious texts that I would read, they would always seem, okay, I understand, I get it, but there was it didn't really attract me. I didn't feel like, oh, okay, I'm going to start practicing this. That's not how any of those were. But with this Quran, it seemed to, I don't know, I guess the right statement's not questions, but it seemed to fit. You know, it was a discipline. There were a lot of things that made sense in it. You know, how to live, why we exist, what our purpose in life is. You know, it just kind of fit in. So, I mean, that's how it was for me. Anyway, I arrived in San Francisco. That's where I was traveling on the bus. And like I normally did with other books, I sought out Muslims. I looked for Muslims. And I found a mosque on the west side of town. At the time, it was just that was the only one in town. And there was a guy there. I spoke to him for a few minutes. I actually kind of told him, hey, I just finished reading this book. And I remember I was really excited when I spoke to him. And he looked at me kind of strange, and he was very calm. And he said, oh, okay. Well, and he gave me another one. He gave me, you know, another copy of the Quran. It was, you know, a hardback book with English and Arabic in it. So Ramadan is the only month, only time we're required to fast.
What is the month of Ramadan?
The month of Ramadan is the month in which the Quran was revealed to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. We say peace be upon him when we say his name. But the month actually existed before Islam. The name Ramadan comes from the root word, letters, Ra, Mim, Dal. So it's, and it means heating up or burning. So that was that month, it was typically hot during that time. So Ramadan existed, but this is the time that the Quran was revealed.
Ramadan isn't always the same time of year, isn't it?
No, we follow a lunar calendar, and Ramadan is the ninth month of the Islamic lunar calendar. Before that, you know, the some of the Arabs follow the lunar calendar. Some of them follow the kind of a quasi-lunar solar calendar, and some of them follow whatever was the local calendar. There were a lot of Jews in Medina and some of the region. So, you know, a lot of the local Muslim tribes or people would follow whatever was local, but they didn't follow the calendar strictly. It was after Islam was revealed that Muslims began to just stick with one calendar. But Ramadan is the ninth month of the calendar. It is the most religiously significant time of the year for Muslims throughout the world. Again, I mentioned it marks the month in which the Quran, which is the holy text of Islam, was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, by the angel Jibreel in 610 Christian era year. I think it's very important that we feed others. You know, you want to go visit folks in the hospital, you know, anything. You really want to show your concern, I should say, you really want to have more concern for others. But feeding others is very important during Ramadan. Feeding other people besides yourself is very important, especially those who are struggling. They, you know, maybe they don't have food or whatever that situation may be. That's very important during the month of Ramadan. Giving in charity, we increase that. And that's the month, really.
Thank you very much, Aladdin.
You're welcome.
This is KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Susan Franzen, your host for this hour. Other voices you heard were Pat Schlarbaum, Doug Haar, Rick Exner, Marissa Barco, Janet Turing, David Hansen, Louis Rosser, and Aladdin Al-Katheri. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests, along with relevant links to today's stories. That's khoifm.org. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Other music you heard were a Salvadoran folk dance and Arabic Sufi music. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 515-292-2878. That's 515-292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. That's also what you need to know to contact us if you decide to become a member or renew your membership today. Just look for the yellow donate button. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.